They say bees are responsible for one-third of every bite of food we eat. Given how much we love to eat, and how much we love to hear the buzzing of the bees, we simply must ask, how does one keep bees in the city?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1362nd edition of the Food Chain Radio Show and podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Christchurch who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Or whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, we all know how important bees are to the productivity of natural and man-made food chains. And so, when we look about the garden and see fewer and fewer bees every year, we get to wondering, what will we do for food should all of the bees disappear? And of course, there would still be pollinators buzzing and crawling about, but would they be sufficient to feed all of us in this hungry world? Have done feature stories about the disappearance of bees here on the Food Chain Radio, I got to watching, and I get to seeing fewer bees every year. But I wonder, am I really seeing things? My wife and I recently decided there was one way to allay our fears about the disappearance of bees, and that's to become metropolitan beekeepers. Today, we take the first step in that direction by asking, how does one keep bees in the city? Well, here to teach us how, we have apiarist and educator Emily Bonder from Santa Cruz Bee Company. Emily, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yes, it's so great to have you now. A beekeeper in Santa Cruz from New Jersey.
Yep.
Good. Are bees disappearing or is it just my imagination?
It's a great question. It's a little bit of a complex question. So when we talk about bees, we have to think about teasing out. Many people think about bees and they, you know, don't know one bee from another necessarily. So I work primarily with honeybees, European honeybees, but there are many, many species of bees worldwide. There's about 20,000 different species of bees worldwide. So that's really important to think about the diversity we have in the world, in the landscape of bee populations. And there's a lot of support that goes to research honeybees. And I'm really hoping that over time, more and more attention goes to more of the native bee species, because that's a really important factor.
Well, I know it's a very fascinating story how the European bee came to predominate here in the United States, but that would take us down.
Of course, yeah. I mean,
that would take us a good hour and a half itself.
Of course. My knowledge base is in honeybees, so we'll primarily be talking about the husbandry and keeping of honeybees.
And that's where we'd like to go.
Exactly.
Good. Yeah. Well, how did Emily become an apiarist anyway?
Yeah, so I was living and working on an organic farm on the island of Maui in the Hawaiian island chain, and I was working on a permaculture farm, doing a permaculture design internship and learning all about, regenerative agriculture. And we had some honeybee hives on the farm. And the gentleman who kept the hives, he would come and we would help him build equipment and he would teach us a little bit about the bees. And of course, we would open up the hive and get to eat the fresh honey right out of the hive, which was magical to have warm, soft wax honeycomb, and just a delightful experience.
So, and you get it all over yourself.
Oh, yeah, it's all over your hands, and you're licking your fingers, and it's quite an experience. Very luscious. So that was a fun moment in time. But he was recruiting. He was starting a business raising queen bees, and the process of raising queen bees, the typical approach is a technique called grafting. And you need to have very good eyesight because the eggs and larvae in a honeybee hive that you need to manipulate to do this queen rearing process, they're very tiny. So he said, I need to have young eyes. And so, yeah, that was over a decade ago. Started working with him and just learned a whole lot about honeybee biology. And I knew I wanted to work outdoors, and I always loved biology, but I also learned that farming was very difficult, not only on your body, but also just all sorts of critters and soil. And, you know, it's a lot.
And the business, too.
Yeah, and the all of it. It's not to say that beekeeping is easy by any means, but I just knew that that was, you know, 5 or so years after people started talking about colony collapse disorder, right, and the bees were in the news more, and it was becoming more apparent how important bees were for the food system. And so I realized that, you know, beekeeping and pollination services within agriculture was a niche, and raising queen bees within beekeeping was a niche too. So I was like, okay, I could see this becoming a career path.
Mm-hmm. And away you went.
Yeah.
And that's how you became an apiarist.
Yes, exactly.
Good. And what's the difference between an apiarist and a beekeeper?
An apiarist is a hoity-toity term for a beekeeper.
Okay, basically
good. The same thing. So it comes from the scientific name for honeybees is Apis mellifera. So the mm-hmm. genus is Apis, and so apiary.
Apiarist. Yeah, okay, apiarist. Got it. Well, I thought a fun way to starting out this would be to list the reasons why we should all become beekeepers. And let's start off with, I just have a bunch of them here.
So sure.
First and foremost, increase pollination.
Yeah, it's a great service to the environment to mm-hmm. have more pollination.
And maybe my avocado trees too.
Yeah.
I hope so at any rate.
Exactly.
So, and that's what bees do.
Yeah, so they go from flower to flower and move pollen around. And create fruit in the process.
A great service to mankind.
Exactly.
And what about just saving the honeybee? Is that a good reason, too? Because that's how I opened the show.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it's it's important to know that honeybees are having a hard time. And so everybody learning more about how important bees are for the food system. And if you start to learn about the experience and process of keeping honeybees, you'll also realize the delicacy of the system that they live in. And that will also just make you appreciate them that much more, I think.
And the nature in which they live, probably.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
All tied together. Honey. You just mentioned how fun it is to eat honey right out of the hive.
Oh, yeah. It's a wonderful experience.
And then it helps you develop a more sustainable lifestyle.
Yeah.
And it's easier than keeping goats.
Probably. It probably is easier than keeping goats. You don't need as much space, which is why you can do it in the city, like we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's a really great endeavor. It puts you in touch with nature in a way that I think a lot of people that, you know, live and work indoors and are in more of that human space.
In front of a computer screen.
Or living, you know, in an apartment and driving their car. And, you know, most humans don't spend very much time outside anymore. And it's not really very easy or very possible to keep honeybees inside. Most people don't want to have bees in their house. So the nature of it, it puts you outdoors, which is a wonderful thing. And it also connects you with the natural systems and cycles and the seasonality mm-hmm. and all of the blooming cycles of the plants in your area. And it kind of connects you to nature in a deeper way.
And it's a good hobby.
Yeah.
Got to do something with yourself
yeah.
instead of hanging around looking at computer screens and
exactly.
watching TV.
Yeah.
Get outside. It's a good hobby. Get yeah. you involved.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep.
And we talked about connecting with the environment. What about the thrill?
Well, that's another piece, too.
Tell us about the thrill.
Yeah. Well, so I was made familiar of the concept of like a flow state, which is where you're focused in something and you kind of lose track of you know, the time and space around you if you're very focused and kind of in a flow. And beekeeping, some people also, you know, talk about how it's almost like a mindfulness practice because you have to be really focused on what you're doing, because at any moment, if the bees sense that something shifts, if there's a gust of wind or you fumble in what you're doing, or, you know, there can be changes that happen, and you have to kind of be able to tune into the energy of the beehive in any given moment, because sometimes you open a hive and they will let you know that it's not a good time for them.
Leave me alone.
Yep. So it just kind of depends in the moment and what you're doing. Mm-hmm. But I think it's really great because it leads to this level of focus and mindfulness that I think can actually be really centering. Mm-hmm.
And give you a thrill.
I mean, so it's, you have to be focused because there is that background sense of a little bit of anxiety of like there could be, you know, something could shift. So you have to be, you know, it's kind of like.
Okay, and outside of your control, something can change really quickly. So you have to be there paying attention. Yep. Very good. Somebody said lighting fires was fun.
Yeah, I mean,
what does that mean?
Well, I'm guessing they're maybe referring to the bee smoker. And so, like I was saying, sometimes you open a hive and they're not so happy with you. If you are in a hive and you have, you know, boxes taken off and there are frames out and you're in a situation where you can't just walk away, if you have to continue to work to at least put things back how they were during your inspection, the bee smoker is a very useful tool because it's there's a few reasons why, but one of them is that it is a very strong scent, and honeybees have this incredible sense of smell, and so the smell of the smoke masks some of their pheromone communication. They have this chemical communication that they do in the hive with all of these different pheromones and allomones.
And they don't send out panic vibes then.
Yeah. And so they will, one of the distinct pheromones they have is an alarm pheromone that they'll release when they sting. And so if you're starting to get stung, you can also use the smoker on yourself in the areas, if you're getting stung on your hands or your clothing, you can smoke the areas that have been getting stung, and that can help to mask or limit the alarm pheromone.
Mollifies.
Exactly.
Kind of settle down, everybody. Yep. And then connecting with the neighborhood.
Yeah. I mean, you have to, one of my, you know, important rules of beekeeping, what I call good neighbor beekeeping, is you, ideally, if you're living in closer quarters, like in a city or suburban environment, it's very good to communicate with your neighbors about having honeybees, because while rare, there are some people who have bee venom allergies. So that's something to be known. A lot of people think they're allergic when they just are having a normal reaction. Mm-hmm. They have a reaction to a bee sting, and so they think they're allergic, but you'd have a histamine reaction anyways.
And
it
is.
Yeah, but it's additionally another reason why it's great to kind of connect you with your neighborhood. It's a great learning opportunity. And
hey, neighbor, come and look at our bees. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. Today we're talking about with beekeeper Emily Bonder, Santa Cruz Bee Company. When we come back, we're going to learn how to do bees.
back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, What's Eating What is going to be us eating some honey. As soon as we can get some bees in our yard so they can convert some of that beautiful pollen that's in all of the flowers and trees and everything into honey. And it's going to be so exciting. But is it exciting?
It is exciting.
Okay.
And I will say one quick correction. Mm-hmm. The pollen doesn't turn into honey, but
that's right.
Nectar from the flowers nectar turns into honey. Right. Yeah. Pollen is also very important for the bees, and they do consume it. But
and you can consume the pollen, too, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. You can consume it in a raw form in those little tiny kernels. Mm-hmm. You can also consume it after it's entered the hive, which is my preferred way, and that's something called bee bread. And it's not really commercially available because it's very hard to process at scale, but it's delicious. It's fermented pollen.
Fermented pollen. There you go. Well, do you often get stung?
Yes.
Everybody asks that, I'm sure.
Yeah, it definitely happens. Not every day. Mm-hmm. Sometimes multiple times a day. Just depends.
And you develop a tolerance for getting stung?
Thankfully, I have, knock on wood. It can change in the lifetime. Most people, you know, at first they'll have kind of a stronger reaction, more swelling and all of that. Right. And then if you get stung regularly, you kind of get desensitized. However, you can also gain more allergy to it over time.
So it's something to watch for. Now, you're an industrial beekeeper, which means you keep a lot of bees for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. So you're more prone to get stung than probably a hobbyist who...
Yeah, I would say so. Just with the sheer number of colonies that I might work in a day is going to be more than a hobbyist.
Who should not be a beekeeper?
Well, probably someone that's anaphylactic, allergic to honeybees. I know some people that do have bee allergies that keep bees, but they just have to really wear the full suit and full protection, and they have an EpiPen, and they know the risks involved.
They're living in the danger zone, aren't they?
In the danger zone, exactly. Okay. Yeah.
And they probably get more thrills than anybody since they are. So allergic people should not. What about lazy people?
Yeah, lazy people, not so much. It's not as intensive of a hobby as some other things. There's a learning curve. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot to learn through kind of trial and error and experience over time.
Isn't that part of the fun?
That is part of the fun. Yeah. I would say, you know, you are going to need to stay, you know, organized and on top of things. And
good. All right. That. Does it cost a lot of money?
Depends on how you do it. Mm-hmm. There are ways to do it very cheaply if you are really industrious. If you build your own top bar hive or have, you know, some sort of beehive. If you like woodworking and you want to make some sort of beehive, you could do that as an alternative. If you are really lucky, you might have a friend that keeps bees that has an extra swarm of honeybees, or you might be able to lure in a swarm. That's harder to do if you don't have any existing bee equipment, because the bees prefer to go to things that have been lived in before. For someone that's brand new, just kind of off the street, typical backyard beekeeper, I would say it's probably in the ballpark of, in our area, with our kind of prices for things in Santa Cruz.
$1 million.
Probably somewhere around $500.
Okay, good.
So the colony itself might be around $200, and then the bee boxes and your protective equipment and tools and stuff will be another $300, something like that.
All right. What are the biggest mistakes I would be inclined to make?
Yeah. Well, there are so many. But I would say probably getting bees and not learning enough about both the bees' biology and the biology of this one very virulent, horrible, ectoparasitic mite.
The
Varroa mite, you know. Yeah, so those are the biggest things that I would say in terms of mistakes and knowledge gaps for new beekeepers. Really just, you know, you don't need to know every single scientific, biological anatomy term of a honeybee or whatever, but understanding the basics of the honeybee brood and life cycle and the varroa mite brooding and life cycle and, you know, kind of their development and how they're intertwined, that's the most important thing for beekeepers, I would say.
Who should keep bees?
Folks that want to have an experience of connection with nature, field biology, just your own sort of interest and edification in learning about a social organism, because the whole super organism,
they call it a colony.
Yeah, it's really fascinating seeing the ways that the bees work together in a, you know, both in a beautifully healthy functioning colony, and also it's really interesting and fascinating to see the ways that things can also go wrong.
So people who love life.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah.
Who should have someone else keep the bees for them?
People who have back problems. Because honeybee hives can be very heavy depending on the style of hive that you have. But the most typical style is those vertical stacking boxes, right, which are called Langstroth hives. And the bees like to put their honey above their brood. The brood is their babies. And honey is very heavy. So it does involve, you know, some amount of heavy lifting. So that's why it's also great to have a bee mentor or a friend or someone that you could do inspections with, because then you, if your boxes do get very heavy, you can lift them together, which is really nice to have.
There's the community.
So there's
right?
a community aspect all to right. it too.
Good. Okay. Well, let's kick it off. How do we go about raising bees in the city? Because it must be different than raising bees out in the country where you put a hive down and walk away for them.
I mean, it is and it isn't. You know, the beautiful thing about honeybees is that they're pretty compact. So unlike, you know, a
herd
cow
of goats
or a horse or any kind of other farm, any right. kind of other, you know, livestock, you need room for grazing and sleeping, and they're just larger, and everything about them is larger. Their food that they need is, you know, you have to buy food for them, for, you know, if you have a goat or something like that, and you know, everything is kind of takes up more space. The honeybees are a lower kind of cost in that you typically you may need to feed them a little bit sometimes, but for the most part, they are able to feed themselves if the conditions are right and good.
Right.
And the boxes and everything, you know, I usually tell folks when I'm going to help them on a site visit, I'll tell them you want about a 4-foot by 4-foot flat level area for your hive. Not a ton of space, you know, so you can have your beehive set up there. That's for one hive. So, yeah, very possible to keep bees like in some of the more urban areas around here. I'll even keep bees up on a rooftop, which is a great thing to do for an urban environment.
Huh. What about the legality of locality?
Yes. So about maybe 6 years ago, we worked to amend the city code of Santa Cruz, because previously there had been permit requirement and permitting fees to have a honeybee hive, and it was like $1,300.
Holy smokes.
Also, no one was enforcing it, so nobody had permits, but there was, you know, one or two times that there were issues with, you know, neighbor disputes or someone got stung or something like that, and, you know, it was sort of like, well, who's responsible and how does this all work out? So, essentially, with City of Santa Cruz, so obviously Santa Cruz County, we've got four city jurisdictions here, but at least with the City of Santa Cruz, we kind of wrote into the amended city code to say, okay, if you talk to your neighbors, if you have at least a 6-foot setback from public right of ways and a 10-foot setback from property lines, and you have a water source in your yard for the bees, and you're, you know, open with your communication with neighbors about having honeybees in the event of swarms or things like that, and everybody around you is gives you the green light, then there's no permit required, and we've just sort of agreed that bees are a positive part of the landscape.
And you were part of making this happen?
I was a part of making. So we have a beekeepers guild here in Santa Cruz, and I've been president on and off for the past 6 years or so. And it was through the beekeepers guild that we kind of were talking with the city and said, hey, you know, maybe we're due to, you know, have a refresh, because we don't have a county. California is really weird in that we don't have a state. Every other state, I think, in the country has a state apiary inspector. And as far as I know, we don't have a state apiary inspector in California, or like regionally. We have a county ag inspector, but we don't have a county apiary inspector, which probably a lot of beekeepers are happy for that, because it means no one's in their business. But it also makes it a little complicated for when issues do arise. Mm-hmm. So as our Santa Cruz Beekeepers Guild, we're kind of the community education hub for when people in the community have questions about all of this sort of stuff.
What about liability?
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely a factor. And so another piece of it that I may have left out, don't quote me on exactly what we wrote into the city code, but I think another piece of it was that you're meant to have your contact information on the beehive in the event of something wrong.
Happens.
If there's a stinging event or okay. something where, you know, there's, or a swarm or things like that. There is liability for sure. It's an interesting space because honeybees can also live in the wild. And so there can be, you know, bees living in a tree in the forest as well. And so it's not like our bees from our own hive have, you know, a little jacket on that says from Steve's hive.
Yeah, okay.
So again, with any sort of, you know, an individual one-off incident of a bee sting or something like that, there's to some degree you can't pinpoint and say, that was your bee, I know it. But for the most part, if there's a hive in an area and it's known that there's maybe aggression, more defensive traits of that hive, if they're a little bit unpleasant to be around, that's sometimes a factor that you have to consider. And there are steps that can be taken to change the queen in the hive, to change the genetics, and hopefully change the downstream behavior.
So that's
so
personality of the hive itself is an issue.
Yes.
Okay, good. Neighbors are important. You have to keep.
Absolutely.
Okay, good. Seasons.
Yeah. So we're really lucky here. We sort of have a slow, long, moderate nectar flow for many months of the year. We do have a dearth typically, and it's that dearth or limit in available food tends to be a lot worse in drought years. It'll be longer, more months, but you know, we do kind of have spring is really wonderful, but then typically there's more of like a hot, dry spell for, you know, anywhere from July, August until about October, November. So not a super long time. But then after that, we then typically start to get rain and have a winter season, which we don't have freezing temperatures. So our hives, if it's above about 50, 55 degrees during the day, the honeybees will still be metabolically active and they'll still fly. So our bees in our area will still, the queen will continue to lay year round, whereas in freezing cold climates, they'll go into a semi-hibernation state called a torpor. So there's definitely a lot of regional differences depending on mm-hmm. where you are in the continental US or in the world. You know, there's different environments and different climates. But there is also just kind of a general seasonality. And it's typically tied to day length and temperature and then what the plants are doing.
Just like a plant.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like a plant. Yep. Photoperiod,
yep, exactly.
Temperature.
Yep.
There you go. What do you do with them in the winter?
They are kind of just hunkered down. You button them up. You want to make sure they have enough food going into winter. So
you don't take all their honey?
Yeah. So it's really important for anyone starting beekeeping, do not take anything out of the hive in the first year. leave everything there. Don't take honey. If you see honey and you get excited, that food is their food for the winter. So we're allowed to eat honey. Humans can totally eat honey, but it's not ours, really. It's their food.
Okay.
So honeybees are really great at being nectar hoarders and making a surplus of food. Typically, they make more than they need. And so if there is a surplus, you usually can take some, but I will say get them through the winter and then wait until the spring starts again. And then if you see, you know, you could mark your frames in your hive and say, you know, harvest in March, ? And then if there's honey left over after winter and they're bringing new food resources in, then you might be able to take some. But
there you go.
It's really important to know that the honey is their food.
Good. All right. Now, let's go to the equipment. Gee whiz, time's flying.
Oh, yeah.
Hives. Is it possible to have just one hive?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
I don't see how it's possible, given the industriousness of bees.
It's also kind of an addictive hobby.
Okay.
And so as soon as you have one hive, you know, I have a woman I work with up in the mountains, and she started with two, and I think she's going to have like six hives this year because she wants to be able to go into a beehive every, you know, twice a week or whatever. And there's a limit to how often you can go in the hive to be,
okay,
you know, you don't
so
want to disturb
have,
the bees too much. So
there you go.
Exactly.
Okay. So it is possible, but not probable.
Yeah. Okay. There's just also, I think it's good to start with two because the loss rate annually of honeybees, like we were talking about at the start of the show and the bees dying.
Goodness, we're out of time, but we'll stay tuned, okay, ladies and gentlemen. Right. We will be right back after these very important messages.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
How would you like to be part of a great mission?
You can help the Epoch Times fight for a free press.
America's news outlets no longer tell you the truth. In fact, 90% of the media is owned by just six corporations.
But honest traditional journalism isn't dead. You can find it in the pages of the Epoch Times. Go to readepoch.com and try it.
1 month for just $1.
When you do, you're supporting real news and helping us in the fight against fake news.
You'll read the truth about how China promotes communism inside the United States and why so many American companies hide the truth about China.
You'll read stories about American politics written without a political agenda.
It's journalism that you don't get from our dishonest legacy media and without the tyranny of big tech.
Be part of a great mission. Subscribe now, 1 month for $1 at readepoch.com. That's readepoch.com.
Here's a little secret I'm telling you. Take a little pledge called the 2x2. Spend $2 on local food each day and get two friends to do the same and play. Oh, they'll spend their money, and when they're through, they'll get two friends and do it too.
We can eat our way to economic security and personal freedom. It won't cost an extra dime, and it will be so easy, it will make you blush. All it takes is two numbers. One is two, the other is 2-2. Join us. Take the 2x2 pledge.
There's a little secret I shared with you, a simple pledge called the 2x2. You can do it. It don't cost much. It's so easy, it'll make you blush. Pledge two local bucks each day. Get two others to pledge and play.
Take your 2x2 pledge at MetroFarm.com.
2x2. So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
So we're talking about the hives now. Got to have hives for the bees. If you don't have a hive, you don't have a colony because they'll fly away.
Exactly.
So that's what the hive is all about, providing them a home.
Yes, shelter.
And now, are there many different kinds of hives, or what I see appear to be white boxes?
Yes, yeah. So just to quickly go back, it's great to start with two hives, I think. You get a little added insurance if you have a colony loss, because the bees have about a 45% annual loss rate. So it's really good to start with two. You have a little added insurance if one doesn't make it. But I will say, especially if you're going to have more than one colony of bees, it's good to have the same style of beehive, so that if you need to at any point interchange any components of equipment, that you have compatible equipment between the hives. The most typical style of beehive is what's called the Langstroth hive, and those are those vertical stacking hives. Another common type of hive is it's called a top bar hive, and that's it just has the top bars of the frame. What normally it would have four sides in a Langstroth hive, and the top bar, it's a horizontal hive, and the bees build all their own comb, and it's sort of like, looks almost like a trough.
Now, my wife was captured by a YouTube video about a European flow hive.
Oh, yes. It's an Australian company, actually. They've been around maybe 8 to 10 years, the flow hive. Mm-hmm. And these have these plastic hive component frames that you turn a key and it opens the cell kind of internally and drains the honey, and then it comes out of this tube. And so their whole thing is like, you can have honey on tap.
On tap.
Yeah.
Well, do they work?
Sort of.
Okay.
I have had some minor success with them.
Uh-huh.
And I've had reports from others that they've had success. So I think they can work, but the bees don't love plastic, in my experience.
I was wondering about that.
They
was the first thing I saw.
They don't prefer it. So no. I would say their favorite is to build their own combs. And then they would prefer like a beeswax foundation. And then there's plastic foundation that has a beeswax coating. And then the flow hives are sort of the least popular, I would say.
Okay. So you have the hive. Where do you want to put the hive?
You want the hive to be in a sunny location. So
sunny.
Think of like, where are you going to put your raised beds that are going to grow your tomatoes? That's going to be where you want to have your honeybee hives too. So good sun, you know, all day sun is fine. Morning sun, afternoon shade is also great if it gets really hot in your area.
That's where we're
going
to put ours. Morning sun,
afternoon shade.
Yeah.
And the orientation of the hive, typically you want it to be facing southeast, so that it gets like the warm sun
in the morning,
kind of wakes them up.
That's what we were thinking.
Yeah, okay. Those are kind of the most important factors.
Just what I would want if I was a bee.
Exactly.
Okay. But what do I want to wear if I'm a person working with bees?
Really,
moon suits?
One
of the moon suits?
A lot of new beekeepers get the full suit, and then the next year they're like, maybe I'll just get the jacket with the veil. And then the third year they're like, maybe I'll just get the veil and gloves. Or, you know, personally, I think I had to wear a full suit when I was starting because the beekeeper I was working with was like nervous about it. But pretty soon the thrill factor. If you wear a little less, you're a little more exposed. There's a chance.
Okay,
but also, personally, I find the beekeeping gloves, they're these thick, bulky leather gloves. They're very hard to work in. They really limit your dexterity when you're manipulating in the hive. So I don't wear gloves because I just find them really difficult to work in.
Mm-hmm.
I'll wear a bee veil a lot of the time, maybe 60 or 70% of the time I'll wear a bee veil.
Wow.
Long sleeves and pants are good to have that option, but you also want to be mindful of, like, this sweatshirt I'm wearing right now has some
gaps. Bees would
get
inside of it.
So it's good to have, like, a tighter cuff, because if you have a loose sleeve,
you'll
have
inside.
Bees crawl up, and then they get stuck, and they get scared, and then they sting you. So it's important to think about that, too.
Okay. The smoker.
Yeah.
So get a smoker.
Smoker's good to have. I would have one.
All right.
The hive tool is the most important.
What is the hive tool?
So the bees make a substance called propolis, which is like a glue that they collect. It's like plant resins and saps. And they use it as a sealant all around the hive when they're between the lid and the hive box and between the frames and all the components of
it's
the
like
hive.
It's like a caulking.
Yeah, it's like a caulk, and it's very, very sticky. And so you need this hive tool, which is like a mini pry bar, to get everything apart. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have that, you won't. You can tug as much as you want, but you're not going to be able to move things around unless you.
You can also use it to get the bee sting off.
Yes, exactly. Flick it out.
There you go. Yep. All right. Anything else with respect to equipment?
Hive tool is really important. The smoker is important. I love having my propane torch that I use to light the smoker. Mm-hmm. I also use it because I work in a lot of hives. I'll use it to clean off my hive tool between working different hives.
Melt the propolis off.
Melt the propolis off and just kind of disinfect and clean off. And then also if you're reusing equipment, sometimes you may want to scorch and scrape the frames or the boxes or things like that. So for me, I feel like a propane torch is excellent. There's so many other gadgets and gizmos that they'll try to sell you, but those are that's kind of the core kit. And then, of course, having some sort of protective
probably a whole Amazon warehouse
jacket.
Full of stuff.
Oh my gosh, right? I know. Yeah, but yeah, having the bee jacket, or like a bee veil with a jacket, or the hat with the long sleeves, or something to at least cover your face and scalp because those stings hurt a lot.
Yeah. Okay. And then while managing the show, because you have to manage it to some extent.
Yeah, it's good to get in. I visit most of my hives about once a month.
When you say visit your hives, does that mean you open them up and look?
Yeah, typically.
Okay, what are you looking for?
And so most of the time I'm looking for the health of the hive. And that's the same, you know, like I'm always going to be looking at those factors, primarily like we talked about earlier, the varroa mite. So I'm going to be looking for a presence of the varroa mite if I'm seeing signs or symptoms of any of the various viruses that they vector, and, you know, the severity of the, you know, how much of an infestation or population there is of the mites, because that can really very quickly.
Can you actually see them?
You can. They're large enough to see the bees. They look like a little, like a tick sort of, about that size.
Oh, how wonderful.
Proportionally, it would be like us having a dinner plate on our body. So they're quite big on the bees, proportionally. They're a little maroon mite. If you see them under magnification, they look just like a crab.
Oh, wonderful. What do you do? When you have varroa mites.
Yeah, the million-dollar question. You can do some different manipulations in your management that don't involve using a treatment for varroa mite, but the most typical way that many beekeepers deal with a serious mite infestation is by using some form of an input of like an organic acid or something like that that will kill the mites off. So that's kind of the most common approach because it's fairly
an organic
effective.
Acid?
Yeah, so formic acid is one that's used a lot. Oxalic acid is another one that's used. And then there are some like heavier duty miticides. And then there's a lot of beekeepers that don't believe in putting anything in the hive. And that's been my approach for a long time, is just I focus on breaking the brood cycle and preventing the growth of the mites in their reproductive process. But that is more difficult and more labor intensive. So it's not generally recommended for brand new beekeepers. Some of the advice that I've heard is like, use a treatment in your first year to make sure the bees can survive. And then in subsequent years, you may be able to do some other sorts of alternative mechanical treatments or things like that.
There you go. A tough one. It's kind of like, well, when you get a bacterial infection, take your antibiotics.
Exactly.
Or suffer the consequences.
So there are a lot of efforts. I'm part of this national group of, you know, 20 beekeepers and researchers around the country called the Adaptive Bee Breeders Alliance. And so what we're working on is trying to really think about positive, healthy breeding efforts so that we can try to breed bees that are more mite resistant. So that's kind of the next approach.
Cultural
is
selection.
About, that cultural selection, exactly.
Amen. Okay, good. Okay, so we have the hives. What about water? Do we have to provide water?
Water is good to put out somewhere. If you have a natural body of water nearby, the bees will find it. it's good. Why we wrote it in to have water available on your property is that they can sometimes be a nuisance of going to your neighbor's swimming pool or hot tub.
Oh, okay. So you're taking care of them.
It's good to have water nearby. You don't want to put it right next to the hive. You want it to be like 20 feet away or more from the hive because they don't go to the bathroom in the hive because they're very clean and hygienic. And so if they are exiting the hive in the kind of surrounding vicinity right near the hive, they know that there may be some contamination in that area. So they want to get their water from further away.
Okay, good. Clever little critters. Mm-hmm. What about other kinds of predators like skunks?
Yeah, so skunks can sometimes be an issue. You know, raccoons and possums and things like that. Rodents can definitely be an issue.
I heard skunks actually eat the bees.
The skunks do eat the bees. That's part of why it's good to have your hive elevated on a hive stand. If your hive is right at ground level and they can get their mouth like right up to the entrance, they have easier access. But what I've heard at least is that if they have to kind of get up to the level of the entrance, then they're underside and their belly is exposed and it's kind of a tender area, and so
the bees can have access to sting them there.
So I live in a rural area and I have some hives that are not too far off the ground, and I haven't thankfully really had issues with skunks. Bear can be a big issue like up in the Sierras and places, but we don't really have that issue here.
Right. Okay. So not many predators then. Rural mites.
And there are some different, like there's an Asian giant hornet in Europe that's really bad. We haven't really had them here much, but they were talking about that quote-unquote murder hornet, the Vespa mandarinia. Thankfully, that hasn't really taken a foothold of populating here, but some of these larger wasp species can be really, really detrimental to honeybee colonies, so that's a big thing to consider and learn about. There are some other emerging pests too. There's a really frightening one called the tropolelapse mite that is nonspecific. It impacts multiple different species of bees, and it reproduces a lot more quickly than varroa mite and all these things. Thankfully, that's still mostly in the region of Southeast Asia, but Apis serrana was the original host of the varroa mite, and then it jumped to Apis mellifera. So we live in a globalized world.
We do.
So it's, you know,
we all share each other's bad things.
Yeah, so we're trying to all learn. You know, there was a lot of parallel conversations when everything with COVID-19 was happening with the bee diseases and everything.
Yeah, there you go. Weather. How do we manage weather when it's storming and raining and the wind's blowing? Mm-hmm. What do we do?
Yeah, make sure that the hive is elevated, so it's not sitting in water. I like to add some extra coverage over my hive, so I'll put like an extra piece of plywood or something to like extend the drip edge and make it drier, and then put, you know, a
some
rock
weight
or brick
on it
or something to keep it down if there's wind. Making sure there's a good platform area for the legs of the hive stand, because I've definitely had rain plus rain and mud and then gopher holes, and I've had hive stands just slip into a gopher hole and the hive topples over. So and then some people, if you're in a really windy area, the propolis does kind of keep the components of the hive kind
glued together,
but I have had lids blow off and things like that, so it sometimes folks will ratchet strap their hives together.
Good. What happens when you have a disaster?
You hope that the bees survive.
There you go.
You have to get back to, you know, you want to get back to put them back together too. Like if it's a rainstorm and the hive blows over and then there's water getting into the hive, the bees are not very good at drying themselves out once they get wet. So, so just trying to prepare as much as you can.
Good. And swarms. What is a swarm?
Yeah. A swarm is the asexual reproductive process of honeybees that happens in the spring. And essentially, it's the way that the parent colony will also kind of rejuvenate itself, because queen bees live anywhere from like 6 months to 3 years, depending. That's kind of an average. But so if they have also when they just start to grow in the spring, they will kind of reach a point where they get very crowded and compact in the existing space that they're in. And even if you do expand them in time, sometimes they're just like
I'm out
of
here.
It's a great. Well, no, they're not. They don't all leave in a swarm. It's about one third of the workforce leaves with the original queen, and then in the hive at the same time, they're raising all of these young baby queens in these little queen cells. And so, if everything goes according to plan, the parent, the queen mother, leaves with about one third of the hive, and the remaining two thirds of those worker bees have all these queen cells that are incubating and emerging in the hive. And then, typically, one of those queens will become the next queen. Sometimes there'll be additional swarms that will be cast out of the hive too, but not always.
Wow. What a show. All just like that. It's over. How do we get in touch with you?
Great question. You can visit SantaCruzBeeCompany.com. I'm also on Instagram and Facebook at Santa Cruz Bee Co, BEECO. I think that's mostly it. Or if you just Google Santa Cruz Bee Company or Emily Bonder, you'll definitely find me.
Are you having fun?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Well, do you think other people can have fun?
Yeah. I would hope so. I mean, I think everybody should have the opportunity to learn about bees.
Well, Emily Bonder, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in out there. Remember Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food.
Yep.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.